Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Ukraine says the ongoing conflict with Russia can only be resolved through diplomacy, while Moscow intensifies its offensive in the Donbass region. Russia bans over 960 prominent Americans, including President Joe Biden, from entering the country in retaliation for similar moves by Washington. And Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison concedes defeat in national elections that end a decade of conservative rule. Thank you for joining us. Russia is pushing to take control of Ukraine's southeastern Donbass region after taking full control of the port city of Mariupol. As our correspondent Johnny Miller reports, Russian forces are moving out of Mariupol and heading for the heart of the conflict zone in Lugansk. Take a listen.
Currently just outside Mariupol, where the last of the Ukrainian soldiers in the Azov battalion are finally surrendering. It's a great victory for the Russians to take Mariupol, but the Ukrainians are also saying that it's a victory for them. Why? Because those fighters at Azovstal were able to hold off or take up time in the Russian army. The Russian army had to surround that steel plant for a long time, stopping Russian soldiers moving elsewhere in the war. And in part, that's correct. When we were coming up this road this morning from Donetsk, we had to wait by the side of a country road for about half an hour as an entire Russian battle group moved past us. Dozens of tanks, dozens of supply trucks, all leaving Mariupol now and heading to where the fighting is in Donbass and Luhansk. Right now, there, the Russian army is trying to encircle the bulk of the Ukrainian army. They're having success using artillery. Even Zelensky, who normally downplays Russian successes, has said today that it is, in his words, hell in Donbass as the Russians use artillery. Many of the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches are dying without even being able to see the Russian army. This road here, we're heading back to Donetsk now. There's a straight road and there's a safe road because on the straight road, there is only about 4 kilometers away at one part is a village held by the Ukrainian army, and they often shell cars coming along. A reminder, the Ukrainians still hold huge parts of Donbass. But the Battle of Mariupol is over. The battle for Donbass and Luhansk is going to accelerate in the next few days.
The Ukrainian president says the ongoing conflict with Russia can only be resolved through diplomacy. In a televised speech, Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine didn't start the conflict, but it has to finish it. While he suggested that Ukraine can be victorious against Russia on the battlefield, Zelensky said a breakthrough can only be reached at the negotiating table. He also recalled Kiev's precondition for continuing talks that Russia does not kill Ukrainian troops who defended the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol. The remarks come amid a deadlock in negotiations between the two sides. On Tuesday, Ukrainian negotiators said negotiations with Russia are on hold without substantial results. Later, Moscow accused Kiev of not wanting to continue talks to end hostilities. Russia blacklists over 960 U.S. citizens in response to Western sanctions. Leading Americans on the Russian Foreign Ministry's list include President Joe Biden, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Hollywood actor Morgan Freeman. The individuals are banned from entry to Russia indefinitely. The ministry says the sanctions are necessary to counter the U.S. attempts to establish, quote, a new colonial world order on the rest of the planet. Moscow has already blacklisted State Secretary Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin. Russia, however, says it remains open to honest dialogue and that it draws a line between the American people and authorities inciting Russophobia. As the war in Ukraine continues, the West is taking measures, spearheaded by the United States, that would add more fuel to the burning flames. That's particularly concerning given the devastating toll the conflict is taking on the global economy. This begs the question, are we looking at a prolonged war in Europe? If so, what would it mean for the rest of the world?
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland Two European nations that opted for neutrality for years flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
I don't think those nations really ought to be scared of Russia. That would be really stupid if they were. Maybe they are that foolish and believe the narrative going on. I think it's more there's a power play. I mean, you look at the sanctions, that's where you really see the intent. And President Biden said this in Poland. He said, we intend that Russia's economy will be half of what it was over years. So that reveals he's planning to continue this for years. Zelensky, even if he were inclined to negotiate, will not be allowed to do it. And I think there's an intent to force governments to pick sides.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative, Dmitry Polyansky, went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February.
Russia had demanded security guarantees from the West before the war began on February the 24th. Had the U.S. and Europe granted that, the conflict could have been totally averted. But instead, the West responded with more pressure on the Kremlin. And now it has practically turned Ukraine into a battleground for a proxy war with Russia. How can the situation be diffused, if at all?
As the war between Ukraine and Russia entered its fourth month, the U.S. Senate passed a $40 billion bill to provide assistance to Ukraine. 86 senators voted for the bill, while 11 others, all Republicans, voted against it, citing its high price tag and the fact that it might not be offset. The bill earmarks $6 billion for arms to be purchased from contractors and sent to Ukraine. It also increases the presidential drawdown capacity from the $5 billion the Biden administration had originally requested to $11 billion. The drawdown capacity allows the president to send away arms and military equipment directly from U.S. stocks at times of emergency.
It used to be the case when you had votes for sanctions against Russia, it would only be two senators voting against. So I think the revolt against this policy is growing. And I can tell you from the campaigning I've been doing and speaking with hundreds of American voters, Americans do not want this war. They don't support spending all this money on weapons. They may not have a completely elevated view of it, but their inclination is to say, we are suffering here. We're paying $1 million a gallon for gasoline. We're running out of baby formula. Why are we doing this? And I want that to be known around the world that the American people are not represented by the policies of this administration.
The war and the subsequent sanctions on Russia have sent shockwaves across the globe, threatening the most vulnerable economies in the world that have yet to recover from the economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic. It's also creating a new global crisis, food shortages.
This is not just about Ukraine. This is about the poorest of the poor around the world who are on the brink of starvation as we speak.
The whole world, including the U.S. and its allies, is paying the price for the war and its ensuing events. The situation would only get worse if the conflict continues indefinitely. The economic, political, and military pressures against Moscow don't seem to contribute to any compromise from the Russian side. The U.S. has expressed its opposition to a prolonged war, but actions speak louder than words.
Australia's opposition Labour Party leader Anthony Albanese claims victory in national elections ending nearly a decade of Conservative rule.
Tonight, the Australian people have voted for change. I am humbled by this victory, and I'm honoured to be given the opportunity to serve as the 31st Prime Minister of Australia.
Australia's outgoing Conservative Prime Minister Scott Morrison already conceded defeat. Morrison said, even though vote counting is not complete, the opposition party looks likely to form a government. Early results show the Labour Party has won 72 House seats and needs 76 seats of the 151 of them to form a government. Albanese's election campaign focused on climate change and spiking inflation coupled with the sluggish wage growth. Australia's inflation has surged to its highest in over two decades, leaving many people concerned about rising living costs. A new list released by British Daily, The Sunday Times, says there are a record number of billionaires in the UK, with the richest 250 people worth more than half a trillion pounds. Released in the middle of a soaring cost of living crisis, this year's list has new entrants, among them a UK government minister and his wife.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily, The Sunday Times' rich list. In this country, it says, 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working, and obviously we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that a majority of the people are facing. We have 4 million people going to food banks, and the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out suddenly out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentments at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men. At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices, and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Purizep, London.
Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for a 17-year-old killed by Israeli forces. Mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes. The victim, identified as Amjad Al-Fayez, was shot dead during a raid on Jenin refugee camp. Another Palestinian teenager was also critically wounded. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya condemned Fayez's killing, stressing that the international community should hold Israel accountable for its acts. The incident came days after the Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akleh while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied territories. Opposition is growing to a cloud technology deal between Israel and two American internet giants, Amazon and Google. Shareholders of both firms will soon vote on resolutions that would mandate reconsideration of the so-called Project Nimbus, which is worth over $1.2 billion. Both human rights observers and company engineers fear that the project will have grave human rights consequences. Last year, a group of anonymous Google and Amazon employees published a letter objecting to their company's participation in the project. They said the technology allows for further surveillance of Palestinians and facilitates the expansion of Israel's illegal settlements on Palestinian land. It would also insulate Israel's computing needs from threats of international boycotts, sanctions, and pressure stemming from the occupation of Palestine. Heavy rains have caused widespread flooding in parts of Bangladesh and India, leaving millions stranded and nearly 60 people dead. In Bangladesh, about 2 million people have been marooned by the worst floods in the country's northeast in nearly two decades. At least 100 villages were inundated after floodwater rushing from India reached a major embankment on the river. 10 people have been killed in Bangladesh and nearly 50 in India. Many parts of Bangladesh and neighboring regions in India are prone to flooding. Experts say climate change is increasing the likelihood of extreme weather events around the world.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. In Britain, a charitable organisation, Action for Children, says levels of severe and persistent hardship in cost of living crisis are among the worst that it has ever seen. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Patrick Butler. The piece is titled, "Poor Families Skipping Meals and Unable to Afford Heating," Charity says. In Britain, hard-up families are skipping meals, wearing coats indoors to stay warm, and living in the dark because they can't afford to switch on the lights, according to a leading children's charity. Action for Children said in one case, a boy it worked with had been off school with sore feet caused by chilblains. The boy told charity workers that the house was cold all the time because the heating was not on, and that he and his siblings were wearing coats inside and sharing beds at night to keep warm. In another case, a parent told charity workers that she would take care of her toddler to bed with their tea when they got back from nursery, just to keep warm. Other clients described being unable to afford school uniforms, or struggling to afford food, or trying to heat a room with a single gas hub. Current levels of severe and persistent hardship among British families supported by the charity's Children's Centre, triggered by cuts to universal credit and rising energy bills, were among the worst that it could remember, said Action for Children's Director of Policy, Imran Hussain. The worst pain and misery of the cost of living crisis is being felt by children in low-income families. Yet the government is refusing to target help for these children, or accept that it needs to rethink its huge cut to universal credit, he said. Ministers have refused to commit to extra direct help for families despite an average annual £700 rise in household fuel costs since April, and also rising food insecurity. Families faced the fastest fall in living standards this year since the 1950s, according to the Office for Budget Responsibility. Children's Hardship Fund set up by the charity Action for Children 2 years ago to provide one-off help to struggling families during the pandemic has evolved into a permanent crisis fund, helping thousands of families, it said. Since October, it has helped almost 2,500 families with grants of about £250 each, half of which were spent on food. Leanne, a mother of two and finance officer from the West Country, said she had needed food vouchers from the Action for Children Crisis Fund because she could not keep up with rising food prices and energy costs. It was a struggle anyway, but things are now so much worse. A lot of people think that food banks are just for people who don't work, but people who work like me need them as well, she said. Analysis of the Crisis Fund showed that half of families accessing it for help reported stress, anxiety, or mental health concerns among the adults or children. One in five applications highlighted the £20 cut in universal credit last October as a trigger for the family's difficulties. Iceland Foods Charitable Foundation, which has donated £300,000 to the fund since November, said that while it was thrilled to help there were limits to its philanthropic work. The charity said government especially had a key role to play in offering a lifeline to families in crisis. Paul Dhaliwal, the trading director of Iceland Foods and a trustee of the foundation, said, "We know that lots of our customers are facing real hardship. Many were badly impacted by the pandemic, and the soaring cost of living crisis has only added to their difficulties." A British government spokesperson said, "We recognise the pressures on the cost of living, and we're doing what we can to help, including spending £22 billion across the next financial year to support people with energy bills and cut fuel duty. For the hardest hit families, we're putting an average of £1,000 more per year into the pockets of working families on universal credit. We have also boosted the minimum wage by more than £1,000 a year for full-time workers, and our household support fund is there to help with the cost of everyday essentials."
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio for today's discussion are two guest speakers, Sayyid Murtaza and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen and Sayyid Murtaza, assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you very much for inviting me to this program.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So today we want to talk about the 104th year in which marks the Balfour Declaration in Palestine. And, this Balfour Declaration, as the Palestinians calls it, has set the stage for the creation of the Israeli entity and the occupation of Palestine. Before getting to the issues that are taking place in Palestine today, let's get back to 1917, Sayyid Murtaza. Explain a little bit about the Balfour Declaration itself.
Oh, thank you very much. You know, this declaration actually prepared a base for occupation by imperial powers during First World War. And, you know, behind this was the Zionist, actually, powers that were present in European countries, specifically talking in Great Britain. We had that strong presence. And this declaration was actually made to prepare, I would like to add a terminology, and that terminology was actually introduced for the first time through this declaration. It was a national home. Mm-hmm. And this declaration was very much stating the fact that Jews and Jewish people actually needed a place for settlement.
That's right.
And this declaration, for the first time, introduced a terminology, a term for Jewish people in order to have a home in Middle East. So that national home was introduced through this declaration. Unfortunately, later, the same term was very much explained and described as a vague one, mm-hmm. because nobody knew about two parts of this declaration, national home. So because Jews were not very much the most bigger population in Palestine.
That's right.
So unfortunately, declaration was for the first time defined in a wrong way. And then based on that wrong definition, future developments were made.
So there was only Palestine at that time and there was no Israel, isn't it?
Of course, no.
As a result of this declaration, you know, a country by the name of Israel was established.
Well, actually, you know, there was a kind of strategic imperial purpose and goal behind creating such a declaration. And Great Britain, especially the Zionist powers inside Great Britain, actually were behind this declaration.
Oh.
So it was actually made in order to benefit only Zionists and those who were actually following this political ideology. So there was no benefit to the Jewish people, in fact, and it was only forcing Jews to move to Palestine and create a man-made, actually, a system. And that was actually the Zionist regime. And we know there was no name as Israel land at that time. So a declaration was only a paper in the first place. Later on, based on the same wrong paper, there were more developments made.
Okay, Sayyid Mohsen, again, the role of Great Britain in establishing a legitimate authority in the Middle East, okay, we could see, you know, the power of the Britons in the other lands too, you know. They had their own ambassadors and embassies in different parts, also in Iran. They were active by supporting the Babis, you know, who wanted to create a kind of fake mysticism or power or something like that in Iran too. They were confronted, of course, by Amir Kabir on that time in Iran. But all in all, I could say that these colonial power had their role in establishing new lands because of their own purposes in the Middle East. What's your take on that, brother?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. When we talk about the British government or the UK, we should bear in our minds that this is the cleverest government or the establishment in the whole world because of their hypocrisy, because of their, you know, having two face. And the main theme which they follow, through which they could rule over some parts of the world, including the Middle East and subcontinent. That theme, or we can say slogan, was divide and rule. Mm-hmm. So they try to divide the people of our place and then they rule over them. And that was the main reason of them having rulership over half of the world, we can say, or most of the countries. Now, this theme of divide and rule was applied on Palestinians as well. That's one side of the, that's one picture. We should look at the other side of a picture as well, that when we see the Holocaust happening and Hitler coming and killing all the Jews while saying that you will appraise me in future when you will know why I killed so many Jews, there was, we can say, like a harm or was a danger by the Jews to the existing, we can say, people or communities who were living in the Europe. Britain also never wanted to entertain Jews in their own country. You know, if Britain was at that time was thinking about the Jews and it wanted to give, you know, favor to the Jews, it should basically assign a specific land for the Jews.
That's right.
There is a big land over there. Okay. And if we can, we can see that. They never did this. But rather what they did is, they introduced this Balfour, we can say, like
declaration
in That's which the statement was, initially the statement was, if I can just read a couple of lines.
Okay.
It says, His Majesty government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's nothing about Zionist regime.
Oh.
It's the establishment as a national home for the Jewish people. Now, the question is, since when we have a home on the basis or the grounds of the religions? Is UK a homeland for Christians, Muslims, Jews? What is it? We don't have anything. So why they did this? Obviously, it shows us that they want to divide and rule on the basis of the religions. And this is what they are pursuing. Until now, we can see what happened in the subcontinent, you know, the Qadiani. There is a religion which was made and supported by the British government. The Wahhabism, Abdul Wahhab, he came up and he established his own government in the Hijaz in the name of Ali Saud, the Saudi tribe from the Najd. So we can see these things happening in the world, which was done by the British government.
The British and the British.
So it says that it was a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavor to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in the Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. The question is, when you made this declaration, today where are you? We can see the Zionist regime expanding their land.
Yes.
I would say these are the thugs who have occupied the land of Jews, Christians, and the Muslims in Palestine.
Yes, the Zionist, you mean.
The Zionist regime. Right. I'm talking about the Zionist regime.
Yes.
Now, when in this declaration they say that they will not harm like the rights that they have, then why they are sleeping now?
Yes.
Why they are supporting them now? Why, when they're occupying the Palestinian lands and they're taking the lands and the homes, destroying the homes of the Palestinians at today's world, why they're not saying anything? Why they're silent on such an object? So it is clearly understood that the British government or the UK always, whenever they make a declaration, especially for the countries other than them, there is a specific benefit for them, and obviously they want to rule the world. They want to become the master of the whole world, and that's what they're pursuing for.
And we know that since then, so many catastrophes took place in Palestine. You know, mass killing of the people and children are taking place over there. And this year, 104 years have passed the Balfour Declaration, and still the Palestinians are suffering. Is it any way to get back to that declaration, Said Morteza, and delete it from history, and then Palestinians look after the rights for the lands or not?
Well, let's look at the other side of this declaration. One side, my brother mentioned, it was actually based on religious facts or religious elements. But actually what is happening on the ground these days is not based or according to any religious principles.
Mm-hmm.
So the political principles and ideologies is taking place all about this declaration. Long before, this declaration was described as a vague one. And these days, people are trying to provide a kind of close description of what was written there. Unfortunately, those lines that my brother just read have been misinterpreted from the first day.
That's right.
So from the political point of view, there are four reasons that so far have been calculated, and these reasons have been circulated even among mass medias. So the first one was that the Jews were actually massacred and prosecuted inside Europe. So they wanted to free these people.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just an excuse for British government to provide a kind of a safe homeland for
or
the
asylum.
Jews. They were looking actually for a protection for
That's
them.
Right.
So the second was actually controlling a very strong African country, and it was actually Egypt.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted actually to have a control over Egypt and Suez Canal. So they had the idea to control, to go and occupy Palestine in order to achieve that goal.
Okay.
The third reason was actually a kind of a strong lobby among British powerful figures and the Jews. When I say Jews, I don't mean actually the Jewish people, the Zionists, those who were actually the masterminds of creating such an ideology. And the third one actually was creating a government
this
as a puppet
third one.
Yeah, that was the fourth. That was the third one.
Third one, okay.
And the fourth one was actually creating a kind of puppet regime in the region in order to have the upper hand and control the countries in Middle East. So as you can see now, Palestine has been used by all superpower countries and is just, you know, creating some kind of problems for the neighboring countries around Palestine.
Right.
So we can see the political aspect was much more stronger than the religious. So I think that was a very strong reason. But if we go back and we plan to have something as a substitution or eradicate this declaration, so we have to go back and see the basics and the base for preparing such a declaration.
That's right.
Unfortunately, it happened around more than 104 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, most Middle East countries were some kind, you know, occupied by these imperial powers. And most Muslim countries were very much involved with their personal, you know,
That's
conflicts.
Right. Okay.
And I don't think we can go and create a kind of resistance to this declaration.
Mm-hmm.
But we have to go deeper and deeper into the layer of history and find some factors, influential factors that could have been actually used as a actually protection against issuing such a declaration.
That's all right.
By the points which brother just mentioned, four points.
Yes.
We can just take a result out of it that the Zionist regime are the servants of the British government.
This is so.
Who are working on the agenda of the, you know, British government in order to
So who is Balfour? Alfred Balfour was a British ambassador, isn't
it?
Yes, it was. It was, it was
whereas
Britain,
whereas
right.
when they think like they have a they have a country for their own, like it is not the case. Basically, the America and the British is nowadays using them, and obviously they are the, you know, puppets.
Yeah, but the question is, why the international community is silent about, I mean, the crime of stealing Palestinian
Well, that's
land,
because of the system that we have in the world. For example, the capitalism is all over the world. And this system, obviously, it only talks about the investors and their benefit. The politicians who come, obviously, they also need some kind of, you know, investment.
That's right.
And they're also, we can say, like imprisoned under the system of the capitalism. Now, under the system, in the system of capitalism, we can see there were, you know, protests where it was 99% against one person. What was that? All those things. So most of these investors and those who have the companies who are running the politicians with their own money, most of them are the Jews.
That's right.
And they're related to the Zionist regime.
Of course, there are still some Jews who criticize the Balfour Declaration, too,
you
but
know? These Jews are not the Zionists.
Zionist ones. That's what we have to distinguish between the Jews
We do this. That's
Zionism.
What I said. Like, the Zionist regime is basically doing that. So the main issue is why the most of the politicians' countries,
That's
we
right.
have the UNO, why they don't talk about it. It's because the finance is being provided by most of the Zionist regime, and obviously they are backing the governments. We can see clearly when there is a discussion in the parliament of, we can say, like the America or UK, yes. They have these representatives over there,
yes,
who are representing.
Yes.
And obviously because
they held their own conference in the US.
It's because the system is corrupted.
Oh.
So until this system is not being changed, until that time, obviously, they are in the power.
That's all right.
Let's look at the issue profoundly, and we will find some really understandable reasons that why Palestine has been named as the occupied land.
Mm-hmm.
We had these occupiers moving all the way from Europe to Middle East and occupying this holy land.
That's right.
So for one very simple reasons, nothing happens unless you have somebody in power in the system.
That's right.
So there was a very strong lobbying group inside the British government, and they were actually lobbying with other communities in the British government because they themselves were believing in the Zionist ideology.
That's right.
So these people, these strong figures in the British government, made this declaration to be identified in the first place, to be interpreted differently, and they put this declaration into practice by themselves.
That's right.
So they brought these Jews just to the Holy Land in order to give them a kind of settlement.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not actually the whole story. The bigger picture was a different one. They wanted to create a regime based on their own benefits.
Yes.
And they did this at the price of other nations.
That's right.
So now the occupied land is, the Palestine is the only land that does not belong only to Jews.
Yes.
We have Christians, Muslims, and even other nations.
Yes.
So Zionist regime is the one that has been brought by these imperials at that time. So I don't think Israel is going to stay there for long.
That's right.
And their presence is not going to last long.
Inshallah, inshallah. Hope and the Palestine will be free one day, inshallah. And Palestine is for Palestinians. Thank you very much, Said Mohsen. And Said Murtaza for presence Welcome. In the program Viewpoints, talking about Balfour Declaration. It was very kind of you. And thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Also, a YouTube channel and Instagram page, Call of Islam Radio. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Give me a fraction and call it solution. Don't give me a prison and call it a home. Give me borders and call it a state. Don't give me oppression and call it
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
in the limelight.
Promises of jobs and investments are doing little to convince a remote Lincolnshire community to agree to hosting the UK's nuclear waste. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Sandra Laville titled, "It's a Bribe: The Coastal Areas That Could Become the UK's Nuclear Dump." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. On the unspoilt Lincolnshire coast, where walkers enjoy the 5 miles of golden sandy beach and families take holidays in the caravan parks beyond the dunes, the efforts of British politicians to persuade the public nuclear energy is green, safe and clean do not seem to be gaining traction. A skull glowers down from the sand dunes to the Mablethorpe beach, a portent of death and destruction, and a throwback to the campaign for nuclear disarmament protests of 1980s. It is here, in a 24-hectare disused gas terminal bordering the beach, that Prime Minister Boris Johnson's big bet on nuclear energy is being tested. Experts on nuclear waste have said that until the UK builds a large underground nuclear waste dump or geological deposit facility, or GDF, to safely store the 700,000 cubic meters of radioactive waste from the country's 20th century nuclear program, two new nuclear plants should be created. It is a problem that has dogged the development of nuclear energy not only in the UK, but across Europe and in the US. How to safely and permanently store the back end of the nuclear fuel cycle. The solution of the GDF was put forward nearly 50 years ago, but the UK is no nearer to putting spades into the ground, and the cost of decommissioning and disposing of the country's radioactive waste has risen to £131 billion. When the Prime Minister recently promised 8 new nuclear plants in as many years, the problem of the highly radioactive waste they would add to the stockpile was not mentioned. However, it is something very much at the forefront of the minds of those living in the remote Lincolnshire village of Teddlethorpe and the neighbouring town of Mablethorpe. Residents learned the seaside resort could become home to a vast nuclear dump, not from officials, but when a local BBC News programme broke the story revealing talks had been taken place for 2 years. According to documents from Radioactive Waste Management, now part of the Nuclear Waste Services, NWS, the gas terminal site is under consideration for the onshore facility, and the dump would be docked 6 miles off Mablethorpe Beach, between 200 and 1,000 meters below the sea. It would be made up of subterranean tunnels and vaults with natural and artificial barriers to minimize the escape of radioactivity. Inside, the waste from the past 50 years of nuclear programs, most of which is temporarily stored at Sellafield at Cumbria, would be deposited and sealed off forever. The dump would also have room for another 73,000 cubic metric of waste from a new nuclear program of up to 16 GW. The revelations sparked a grassroots protest, which appears to have spread quickly among the retired population, many of whom moved to the area for its coastal beauty. Anti-nuclear signs dominate country lanes, skeletons have been erected on the beach and outside homes, and a series of public meetings have been held over the past 8 months by a group called Guardians of the East Coast. Sarah Bright, who lives in Mablethorpe, says, "I was totally shocked when we found out," adding, "this area was just not elsewhere we ever thought they would put a nuclear dump." This is a tourist area. We have this beautiful beach. There is investment in tourism here. We rely on that tourism income, and the idea that they could consider putting a nuclear dome here is just shocking to me. It is responses such as these that have repeatedly seen off attempts to build an underground dump for nuclear waste in the UK. One 9 years ago in Cumbria was rejected after an impassioned campaign by environmentalists and local people. However, NWS says this time the approach has been different. The government agency privately acknowledges that attempts in the past to find a site for a dump have been shrouded in secrecy. Any location for GDF has to be based on science, the geology of the area, and the technical requirements of a mammoth engineering project. Crucially, though, the community that will host it must also be supportive. This time, NWS invited communities to put their area forward. Four areas have identified themselves as willing to consider hosting the facility: Allerdale, Mid Copeland, and South Copeland in Cumbria, and Teddeltor. NWS promises the community that hosts the dump will benefit from great economic development opportunities, including jobs and investment in roads and railways. In Lincolnshire, a community partnership is in the process of being set up. John Collins, a former leader of Nottingham City Council and the independent chair of the working party set up in Teddeltor to decide on GDF, has been holding meetings to provide information and answer questions from local people for several months. He says, "If this was just a process of someone trying to sell an idea to the community, I would not have been interested in taking part," claiming, "What I think is really interesting in public opinion terms is that sense of this is a big infrastructure project and it has got local implications. We need to work with the community and we are asking the community to make a judgment on this at the end of the process, and if people don't want it, then it doesn't happen." John Collins claims, "We talk to people about safety, about why the area is being considered and what kind of timescale we are talking about," adding, "Most people are reasonably open-minded. Some people are pretty much not in favor, and some are concerned about the potential impact locally." An initial assessment has concluded that the Lincolnshire site has the potential to host a GDF. Acknowledging the natural beauty of the area, NWS promises it will contribute to protecting conservation areas around the site and incorporate flood mitigation measures. The agency has also attempted to placate those who complain the dump will kill tourism in the area. The assessment claims there may be an opportunity to create a GDF Scientific Center of Excellence, which itself could generate significant visitor traffic and even become a tourism point of interest. For the Mablethorpe councillor and Labour leader on East Lindsay District Council, Tony Howard, NWS's promises on behalf of government are nothing more than a bribe. He said, "Suddenly they want us to have a nuclear dome and they are promising us railways, roads, local jobs. It's just 30 pieces of silver, a bribe. The idea that everyone is going to go from selling burgers in the summer to becoming nuclear experts and working on this site is ridiculous. There will be specialists brought in to do this work." He questions the very idea that nuclear energy is green, clean and safe at all. He said, "We know very well in this area the dangers of nuclear. Every year we host children from Chernobyl who come to the seaside for a holiday. We are fully aware that if things go wrong at a site like this, they stay wrong permanently, and that does not sit well with trying to promote the town as a place with a super beach, which is wonderful for families. It jars," adding, "We should be investing in solar, wind, desalination. This site would be perfect for that. Nuclear is a folly." Ken Smith of Guardians of East Coast is worried that the process of reaching a decision could take up to 15 years. He said, in that time, tourist investment will drain away. Why would you want to invest in a caravan park if you think a nuclear dump is going to be built next to it? This whole process should stop right now. As the tourist season in Mabel Tor begins, NWS appears to be spreading its bats, seeking other areas to come forward. Its director for community engagement and sitting Simon Hugh says the UK search for a suitable site is about engaging in dialogue with communities and building an understanding of what hosting a GDF might mean for them so that we can all make an informed decision. He asserted the previous process was very rigid and demanded decisions were made at set points and before all the information was available, claiming the new process allows communities to engage in a much more flexible way, allowing questions to be answered without commitment. Communities also have the option to withdraw from the process at any time and will have to give explicit consent before construction can commence. If the local community doesn't want it, it won't happen. Simon Hugh claimed, with over 60 years of legacy waste currently stored temporarily in surface sites around the country, developing a GDF is about delivering a safe, secure, and environmentally sound long-term solution that protects current and future generations, ensuring it works for the host community and the country as a whole.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.